after him, Faulkner, West, Pynchon, Cormac McCarthy. Like Prometheus in ancient and in romantic literature, and like Milton's Satan, Ahab opposes himself to the sky god, even if you want to call that god Yahweh or Jehovah. Ahab appears to have converted from Quaker Christianity to a Parsi version of Manichaeism, in which the cosmos is in contention between two rival deities. The demonic captain of the Pequod has smuggled on board a crew of Parsis, Persian Zoroastrians from India, to man his personal whaleboat, with Fedala as harpooner. Fedala is Ahab's shadowy double at the end of the great chapter 132, The Symphony. Ahab stares at the ocean and observes two reflected, fixed eyes in the water there. They are Fedala's eyes, yet also Ahab's own. Melville was not a Christian, and tended to identify with the ancient Gnostic heresy, in which the creator god of this world is a bungler and impostor, while the true god, called the stranger or alien god, is exiled somewhere in the outer regions of the cosmos. Early, Major Faulkner is a kind of unknowing Gnostic. West, Pynchon, and McCarthy, in their different ways, are very knowing indeed. My subject is how to read their best fiction, and why, and not how to instruct my own readers in ancient heterodoxies, at least not here. But the first sequence of four novels that I have chosen in the wake of Melville achieve their negative splendors in modes parallel to Gnostic visions, as we will see. In the book of Job, Yahweh boasts to the wretched Job of the power over humankind of Leviathan, whom Melville names the white whale, Moby Dick. Maimed by Moby Dick, Ahab asserts his own pride and will to vengeance, his own spark or flame, invoked by him in chapter 119, The Candles. O thou clear spirit of clear fire, whom on these seas I, as Persian, once did worship, till in the sacramental act so burned by thee that to this hour I bear the scar, I now know thee, thou clear spirit, and I now know that thy right worship is defiance. To neither love nor reverence wilt thou be kind, and e'en for hate thou canst but kill, and all are killed. No fearless fool now fronts thee. I own thy speechless, placeless power, but to the last gasp of my earthquake life will dispute its unconditional, unintegral mastery in me. Come in thy lowest form of love, and I will kneel and kiss thee. But at thy highest, come as mere supernal power. And though thou launchest navies of full-frighted worlds, there's that in here that still remains indifferent. O thou clear spirit, of thy fire thou madest me, and like a true child of fire, I breathe it back to thee. You rightly worship fire, according to Ahab, by asserting your own sacred selfhood against it. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me, the Promethean Ahab cries out, establishing a standard of defiance that no one in his wake has matched. I have confined my reading of Moby Dick to a brief analysis of Captain Ahab, since he is the forerunner of all the American questers I will consider in this chapter. But I cannot abandon Melville's epic, a book I have venerated since childhood, without praising its extraordinary zest as a narrative. We are captured by Ahab even as we recoil from his monomania. He is American through and through, fierce in his desire to avenge himself, but always strangely free, probably because no American truly feels free unless he or she is inwardly alone. William Faulkner, As I Lay Dying. The finest opening section of any 20th century American novel belongs to William Faulkner's masterpiece, As I Lay Dying, 1930. The book consists of 59 interior monologues, 53 of them spoken by members of the Bundren family, a proud clan of poor whites, who struggle heroically through flood and fire to carry the coffin containing the corpse of their mother, Addie, back to the graveyard in Jefferson, Mississippi, where she wished to be buried next to her father. 19 of the sections, including the first, are spoken by the remarkable Darl Bundren, a visionary who finally crosses the border into madness. We hear Darl speaking the novel's opening as he follows his enemy brother Jewel up to the house where Addie is dying. Jewel and I come up from the field, following the path in single file. Although I am 15 feet ahead of him, anyone watching us from the cotton house can see Jewel's frayed and broken straw hat a full head above my own. As Darl and Jewel mount the path, Darl hears the saw of his carpenter brother, Cash, who is making the coffin for their mother, and we listen to Darl's dispassionate observation, "A good carpenter. Addie Bundren could not want a better one, a better box to lie in. It will give her confidence and comfort." Unloved by Addie, the dissociated Darl insists he has no mother, and his extraordinary consciousness reflects his conviction. Stark, simple, dignified, suggestive, the opening of As I Lay Dying intimates the superb originality of Faulkner's most surprising novel. Faulkner's principal rivals have nothing comparable. F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby begins with Nick Carraway's father telling him, "Just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had," which is a healthy admonition not to criticize others, but a long way from the Faulknerian sublimity. Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises begins with the ironical observation that Robert Cohn was once middleweight boxing champion of Princeton. Again, Faulkner is rather beyond that. The only possible rival for an opening in Faulkner's class seems to me the start of Cormac McCarthy's astonishing Blood Meridian, 1985, where the narrator introduces us to the Kid, the tragic protagonist who will finally be destroyed by the uncanny and Iago-like Judge Holden. See the child. He is pale and thin. He wears a thin and ragged linen shirt. He stokes the scullery fire. Outside lie dark, turned fields with rags of snow, and darker woods beyond that harbor yet a few last wolves. His folk are known for hewers of wood and drawers of water, but in truth his father has been a schoolmaster. He lies in drink. He quotes from poets whose names are now lost. The boy crouches by the fire and watches him. The accents of Herman Melville and of Faulkner fuse in this great prose. But Blood Meridian comes at the end of my sequence, so I return us to As I Lay Dying. A deliberate tour de force, the book refers in its title to Addie Bundren, who dies soon after it begins. But Faulkner quoted from memory the bitter speech of the ghost of Agamemnon to Odysseus, Odyssey, Book 11, The Descent to the Dead. "As I lay dying, the woman with the dog's eyes would not close my eyes for me as I descended into Hades." Murdered by his wife and her lover, Agamemnon and his fate have little to do with Faulkner's novel. Faulkner wanted the phrase rather than its context, and took it, though he may also have wished to suggest that the lack of love between Adibundran and her son Darl has elements in it akin to the Clytemnestra relationship with Orestes and Electra. Clytemnestra is the woman with the dog's eyes, who sends Agamemnon open-eyed into Hades, and Adi is, if anything, more unpleasant than Clytemnestra. Though Faulkner does not number the sections, or 59 interior monologues, that make up his book, I suggest that the reader do so in her paperback copy of As I Lay Dying, for convenience of cross-reference. The best edition is the current vintage reprint, which has the Library of America corrected text. Addie speaks only one section, the 40th, pages 169 through 76. But it is more than sufficient to alienate every reader. I could just remember how my father used to say that the reason for living was to get ready to stay dead a long time. And when I would have to look at them day after day, each with his and her secret and selfish thought, and blood strange to each other blood, and strange to mine, and think that this seemed to be the only way I could get ready to stay dead, I would hate my father for having ever planted me. I would look forward to the times when they faltered, so I could whip them. When the switch fell, I could feel it upon my flesh. When it welted and ridged, it was my blood that ran, and I would think with each blow of the switch, now you are aware of me. Now I am something in your secret and selfish life, who have marked your blood with my own for ever and ever. One sees why this sadistically disturbed woman wishes to be buried next to her father. Addie dead is even more of a curse than when alive, as we are told the grotesque, heroic, sometimes hilarious, always outrageous saga of how her five children and husband go through flood and fire to carry her corpse back to her desired resting place. Faulkner's As I Lay Dying is tragic farce, yet it has enormous aesthetic dignity and is a sustained nightmare of what Freud grimly called family romances. Some pious critics have tried to interpret As I Lay Dying as an affirmation of Christian family values, but the reader will be baffled by such a judgment. As elsewhere in Faulkner's great decade as a novelist, 1929 to 1939, the novelist's vision founds itself upon a horror of families and of community, and offers the one value of stoic endurance, which does not suffice to save the gifted Darl Bundren from the madhouse. So ironical are the tonalities of Faulkner's interior monologues, particularly of Darl's 19 soliloquies, that the reader may feel at first that Faulkner does too little to guide our responses. There is no genre we can turn to in aiding our understanding of this epic narrative of Mississippi poor whites fulfilling the dying request of their quite dreadful mother. Family honor is almost the only principle holding the Bundrens together, since the father, Ants, is in his own way as destructive as Addie. Ants is given three monologues, numbers 9, 26, 28, if you have numbered them, and they establish him as wily, shiftless, a trickster and manipulator, as selfish as his wife Addie was. Dewey Dell, the one Bundren daughter, has her own dignity, but cannot find strength to mourn her mother's death, because as an unmarried, pregnant, poor white young woman, she is compelled to seek vainly for a secret abortion. The child Vardaman simply denies Addie's death. He bores holes in her coffin so that she can breathe, and finally identifies her with a large fish he caught as she lay dying. My mother is a fish. Faulkner centers the novel on the consciousness of Darl Bundren, and on the heroic actions of the other sons, Cash, the carpenter, and Jewel, the horseman, and his natural son, through an adulterous relationship with the Reverend Mr. Whitfield. Jewel is fierce, fearless, and capable of expressing himself only through intense action. His one monologue, number 4, in protest against Cash's coffin-making, concludes with a possessing vision of guarding his dying mother against the family and all the world. It would not be happening with every bastard in the county coming in to stare at her, because if there is a God, what the hell is he for? It would just be me and her on a high hill, and me rolling the rocks down the hill at their faces, picking them up and throwing them down the hill, faces and teeth and all, by God, until she was quiet. Jewel and Darl hate one another with mutual passion, and there is a dark, implicitly incestuous hostility between Darl and Dewey Dell. Cash, who is on warm terms with all his siblings, is simple, direct, and heroically enduring, and, like Jewel, a man of unreflective physical courage. But Darl is the heart and the greatness of As I Lay Dying, and clearly Faulkner's surrogate narrator. Darl ends in what looks like what we call schizophrenia, but his uncanniness and visionary power cannot be reduced to madness. All of his 19 interior monologues are remarkable, as here in the conclusion to number 17. And since sleep is not, and rain and wind are was, it is not. Yet the wagon is, because when the wagon is was, Addie Bundren will not be. And Jewel is, so Addie Bundren must be. And then I must be, or I could not empty myself for sleep in a strange room. And so if I am not emptied yet, I am is. How often have I lain beneath rain on a strange roof, thinking of home? Doubting his own identity, Darl has a Shakespearean awareness of nothingness, which is a version of Faulkner's own nihilism, again in his great phase 1929 to 1939, and of Faulkner's wartime experience, of training for the British Royal Air Force, but never taking off in a plane. Darl, too, has been away at World War I, but it has left little mark upon his consciousness. Hating the terrible wagon odyssey of bringing Addie's corpse back to its birthplace, Darl nearly sabotages the effort with a barn burning. But this only inspires Jewel to fresh heroics. Darl is a knower, as Faulkner continuously emphasizes. He knows that his sister is pregnant, that Jewel is not Anse's son, that his mother is in no true sense his mother, and that the human predicament is a kind of aboriginal disaster. And he knows that even the landscape is an emptiness, a falling away from a prior reality, as here in section number 34. Above the ceaseless surface they stand, trees, cane, vines, rootless, severed from the earth, spectral above a scene of immense yet circumscribed desolation, filled with the voice of the waste and mournful water. An intuitive poet and metaphysician, Darl is dangerously close to a verge over which he must fall. His psychic wounds are the legacy in him of Addie's coldness and Anse's selfishness. He is fated for alienation. No escape is possible for Darl. His only sexual desires are for his own sister, and his family is his doom. In Darl's final monologue, number 57, he is so dissociated from himself that all his perceptions, uncannier than ever, observe him in the third person. Two guards escort him to the state asylum on the train, and we hear his voice at its most shattering. One of them sat beside him. The other sat on the seat facing him, riding backward. One of them had to ride backward because the state's money has a face to each backside and a backside to each face, and they are riding on the state's money, which is incest. A nickel has a woman on one side and a buffalo on the other, two faces and no back. Darl, split in half, holds conversations with himself, yet remains a seer. The state's money, which is incest. The passage is haunted by Iago's Rabelaisian jest of heterosexual love being a beast with two backs. Yet there is a deeper Shakespeareanism in seeing the state's money as being incest. Measure for Measure is close by. The reader must find As I Lay Dying difficult. It is difficult. Yet legitimately so. Faulkner, who acutely felt the need to be his own father, infuriates some feminists by his obsessive, implicit identification of death and female sexuality. Darl's sanity dies with his mother, but in some sense his derangement makes explicit what is muted in his siblings. Nature, in As I Lay Dying, is itself a wound. André Gide oddly observed that Faulkner's characters lacked souls. What Gide meant to say is that the Bundrans, like the Compsons in The Sound and the Fury, had no hope, could not believe that their doom would ever lift. God will not make any covenant with the Bundrans or the Compsons, perhaps because they come out of an abyss and must go into it again. That may be why Dewey Dell cries out so desperately that she believes in God. As I Lay Dying portrays the human condition as being catastrophic, with the nuclear family the most terrible of the catastrophes. Nathaniel West, Miss Lonely Hearts. Flannery O'Connor associated As I Lay Dying, in spirit, with Nathaniel West's Miss Lonely Hearts, and called them her two favorite modern novels. Her insight was worthy of her. Not on the surface, but in their depths, there is an affinity between these two apocalyptic books. Like As I Lay Dying, Miss Lonely Hearts is tragic farce and not satire. West, a parodist with rancid genius, achieved his masterwork in Miss Lonely Hearts. Published when West was just 30, Miss Lonely Hearts might in time have been surpassed by its author, who died in a car crash at 37. And yet the book is so sublime in its negativity, so perfect in its farcical despair, that one would not wish it different or better. The reader encountering Miss Lonely Hearts for a first time will be startled, but it is not a difficult book, such as I Lay Dying. West, born Nathan Weinstein, is certainly the major American Jewish writer before the recent phase of Philip Roth that has produced Sabbath's Theater and American Pastoral. Something of a Jewish anti-Semite, with no interest in or knowledge of Jewish esoteric tradition, Kabbalah. West, ironically, became a significant literary figure in the history of Jewish Gnosticism. A reader desiring to find appropriate context for Miss Lonely Hearts ought to read the great essay Redemption Through Sin in Gershom Scholem's The Messianic Idea in Judaism. West risks two unsympathetic protagonists in his superb short novel. Miss Lonely Hearts, who writes the agony column in the New York Post-Dispatch daily newspaper, and his editor, Shrike. We are never given any other name for Miss Lonely Hearts, a humanly inadequate would-be Christ, but Shrike's name could not be bettered. Shrikes are small to medium-sized birds, with remarkably hooked bills and rather nasty face masks. Their name in Latin, Lanius, means butcher, and shrikes are commonly called butcher birds, since their practice is to impale insects on the thorns of bushes and then devour their prey. That suggests crucifixion, and Shrike is a kind of American Satan who torments Miss Lonely Hearts and would crucify him if he could. There is a desperate tonality throughout the novel, a savagery almost hysterical in its intensity. This style suits Miss Lonely Hearts' nature and predicament. He is a fallen American Adam, a would-be Walt Whitman, proclaiming universal love, but cold to his core. Shrike, as much as Miss Lonely Hearts, is consumed by religious hysteria, by a despair that emanates from a nostalgia for God, a longing for Christ. West foregrounds the novel by letting the reader understand that, well before the book opens, Shrike's endless and eloquent, impaling language has already destroyed Miss Lonely Hearts. Crossing a little park, Miss Lonely Hearts walked into the shadow of a lamppost that lay on the path like a spear. It pierced him like a spear. West regarded his book as a lyric novel. Nearly every sentence counts in a spectacular verbal economy. The reader may be haunted, as I am, by certain letters received by Miss Lonely Hearts for his agony column, particularly by one from a 16-year-old girl who was born without a nose. "I sit and look at myself all day and cry. I have a big hole in the middle of my face that scares people, even myself, so I can't blame the boys for not wanting to take me out. My mother loves me, but she cries terrible when she looks at me. What did I do to deserve such a terrible bad fate?" We laugh at this, but defensively, as we tend to laugh uneasily at all the grotesque violence in which West abounds, and which will literally destroy Miss Lonely Hearts in the novel's final sentence. The 15 tableaus, each with its title, seethe with violence, repressed or overt. Even a reflection on a late spring prompts, "It had taken all the brutality of July to torture a few green spikes through the exhausted dirt." Shrike and Miss Lonely Hearts are inverted doubles, both representing West himself, split between the satanic intelligence of Shrike and the inability to believe of Miss Lonely Hearts. So convinced is the latter that the whole world is dead that he wondered if hysteria were really too steep a price to pay for bringing it to life. Shrike's demonic greatness achieves its negative epiphany in the 8th section, Miss Lonely Hearts in the Dismal Swamp, where the reader is offered a superb parody of all the ways out she might choose to take. One hears West himself in Shrike's savage send-ups, starting with D.H. Lawrence's sexual vitalism. "You sow and weep and shivy your kine, not kin or kind, between the poignant rows of corn and taters. Your step becomes the heavy sexual step of a dance-drunk Indian, and you tread the seed down into the female earth." The parody of Herman Melville's early primitivism in Typee and Omu seems to me even funnier. "Your body is golden brown like hers, and tourists have need of the indignant finger of the missionary to point you out. And so you dream away the days, fishing, hunting, dancing, swimming, kissing, and picking flowers to twine in your hair." One can almost be fond of Shrike for the lovely narcissism of picking flowers to twine, not in the beloved's hair, but in one's own. The wonderful parodies go on. the very best of them being The Last Word on Aestheticism, The Faith of the Sublime Walter Pater, and The Divine Oscar Wilde. Tell them that you know that your shoes are broken, and that there are pimples on your face, yes, and that you have buck teeth and a club foot, but that you don't care, for tomorrow they are playing Beethoven's last quartets in Carnegie Hall, and at home you have Shakespeare's plays in one volume. The placement of that yes is wonderful, and the aesthetic is dismissed as another tiresome evasion akin to drugs, alcohol, and suicide. Mounting to the satanic summit of his eloquence, Shrike cries out, "All is desolation and a vexation of the spirit. I feel like hell." He is hell, nor is Miss Lonelyhearts out of it. The second half of the novel depicts the descent of the American failed Christ into the abyss of Fay Doyle, ungratified wife of Peter Doyle, the name of Walt Whitman's beloved. In the heartless final section, grimly entitled, "Miss Lonelyhearts Has a Religious Experience," the crippled Doyle arrives with a gun. Miss Lonelyhearts, become Christ, greets him ecstatically. The gun inside the package exploded, and Miss Lonelyhearts fell, dragging the cripple with him. They both rolled part of the way down the stairs. Those are the final words of Miss Lonelyhearts, and are an epitome of Nathaniel West's vision. How to read Miss Lonelyhearts? With nervous attention, appropriate to a lyric novel, that is at once a parody of American religiosity and a major instance of its prevalent power. No nation, as West prophesied, is now as religious or as implicitly violent as we are. A mere handful of Americans do not believe in God, and only another handful of those who do fail to believe that God loves each one of them on a personal and individual basis. Baruch Spinoza, the great Dutch Jewish philosopher of ethics, famously remarked that it was essential that we learn to love God without ever expecting that he would love us in return. I do not know of a more un-American statement. Why read Miss Lonelyhearts? To understand better our obsession with guns and violence, our fanatic need to be loved by God, our Gnostic roots, which we deny overtly, that teach us redemption through sin, but most of all to experience the pleasures provided by our greatest of parodists since Mark Twain himself. We will have no more Nathaniel Wests. Literary parody expired with him, though it had a brief afterglow in his brother-in-law, S.J. Perlman. Flare-ups of the mode in the late Terry Southern and in the metamorphic Gore Vidal have subsided. There were Hemingway's self-parodies in his later years, and Norman Mailer's still later parodies, both of Hemingway and of himself. All these formidable talents have been subsumed by American media realities. Who can match television news and talking heads, and even the Daily New York Times, in self-parody? Reality in America is more grotesque and hilarious than any parodist could hope to trump. There is something curiously wistful now about Miss Lonelyhearts, a judgment upon my part that would have infuriated Nathaniel West. Still, he was not a satirist, secretly hoping to improve us, but a demonic parodist, providing some music to celebrate our march down into hell. Read him for his prophecy, and for the unsettling laughter he will bring you, as you too approach the abyss prepared for the American soul by the American religion. Thomas Pynchon, The Crying of Lot 49. Oedipa Moss, the heroine of The Crying of Lot 49, in one way resembles the ideal reader of How to Read and Why. Oedipa's quest is to discover how and why to read the story in which she finds herself. Pynchon's Oedipa is not always a good reader, but she deserves her first name. Like Sophocles' Oedipus, she unceasingly seeks the truth. We never learn whether she is on its track, or whether she is the victim of a paranoid joke played by her deceased former lover, Inverarity, a name whose relation to truth is ambiguous. The crying of Lot 49 never stops teaching you how to read it, but since the teaching is ambivalent, the reader is left in doubt about the how. What is clearer is why one should read this short novel. It carries on compellingly from As I Lay Dying and Miss Lonely Hearts, and is the next step in achieving an apocalyptic understanding of the United States. The best advice for a reader of The Crying of Lot 49 is to ignore clues that are too obvious, such as the Pentecostal references that flicker throughout the book. Pynchon plies you with redundant information, and much of it is white noise. He is a playful cabalist of the tarot pack variety, so that anything in the novel can mean everything or nothing. The initial pleasures of The Crying of Lot 49 may be the best clues to its meaning. It is wildly funny, but not with the cruel humor of Miss Lonely Hearts. Pynchon, too, is a parodist, but not a savage one, and the reader, unless jaundiced, ought to become very fond of Oedipa Moss, who always means well, even when she does not know what it all means. Oedipa's all but universal goodwill is a piquant contrast to the paranoid conspiracy of the Tristero that she either uncovers or else partly invents. Even paranoids have enemies, but Oedipa has none, unless the deceased Inverarity is playing that role from beyond the grave. Oedipa in the Tristero universe can never know all the facts because they proliferate endlessly on every side. The book's best critic, Sir Frank Kermode, points out that Oedipa loses all her friends, whether to death, madness, or infatuation, until her isolation is complete at the close. In this, again, she stands for the reader, no matter how many commentaries or companions The Crying of Lot 49 accumulates. And yet, Oedipa is not insane, nor are most of the readers, and so, being myself a cabalist, I vote for the reality of Tristero, thus transgressing Pynchon's apparent intentions. And yet, one can wonder as to those intentions, not so much as to their existence as to their pragmatic importance, since Pynchon, partly in the mode of Kafka, has made himself uninterpretable, except by the reader's personal and perhaps arbitrary choice. Thus, as a passionate admirer of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, 1985, published not 2 decades after The Crying of Lot 49, I wonder if Pynchon's 49 does not have some reference to the California Gold Rush of 1849. Pynchon intimates that the Tristero reached the United States in 1849 to 1850, which is when most of the slaughter in McCarthy's novel is enacted. One motive for the expedition of the Glanton, Judge Holden paramilitary force is to take the scalps of as many southwestern Native Americans as possible, so as to clear the way to the gold fields. Glanton's raiders become their own anarchic government, and even their own communications system. McCarthy, a Faulknerian and not a Pynchonite, is thus linked to the Tristero in my own reader's paranoia. The Tristero is at once Pynchon's most surprising invention in this novel, and perhaps also a historical reality, insofar as it began as the enemy of a European private postal system owned and operated by the noble house of Thurn and Taxis in early modern times. In 19th century America, the Tristero assaults both the Pony Express and Wells Fargo. Also spelled T-R-Y-S-T-E-R-O, Tristero, this shadow organization is anarchist in its apparent ideology, rather like the London Underground movement of Joseph Conrad's The Secret Agent and Henry James's The Princess Casamassima. And in a more comic register, G.K. Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday. There is also a Borgesian touch to the Tristero. It has some of the stigmata of those conspiracies that reorganize reality, such as Borges's Cologne. How ought the reader to regard the Tristero? Clearly, it is a good or a bad thing, depending upon your perspective. My own experience as a reader is that Faulkner's As I Lay Dying captured me the first time around, though only with rereading could I put it together. West's Miss Lonely Hearts also won me over immediately, its gorgeous rancidity being irresistible, though again rereadings added understanding to my admiration. But my first reading of The Crying of Lot 49 was mostly an exasperation. At second reading, the book suddenly took me over and has held me ever since. I therefore urge readers who may not know the book to begin by reading it twice through. What perhaps irritates at first becomes a dazzlement, and one of the centers of that enchantment is the Tristero, an ambiguous but sublime myth-making. At once a tryst or erotic encounter and a melancholy, the name Tristero pretty much means what the reader wants it to mean. Is there terror in it, or a sacred terror? Perhaps, like so many underground societies, the Tristero is at the least morally ambiguous. Pynchon in Gravity's Rainbow could be judged to advocate what he calls pseudo-anarchism, and that may be the most accurate ideology to associate with the Tristero. Yet all this is at times hilariously funny, as in the grand send-up of a Jacobean revenge play, The Courier's Tragedy, by Richard Warfinger, a fit companion for Cyril Tourneur, John Ford, and John Webster. The pages giving a plot summary with outrageous excerpts of The Courier's Tragedy, pages 65 through 75 of the Harper Perennial Library paperback, provoke simultaneous laughter and horror, though more of the former. The Crying of Lot 49, though it might seem to be an open-ended allegory, in the sense that allegory always means something other than what is said, can never quite be an allegory of any kind, because Pynchon has no definite doctrine to propose, whether religious, political, philosophical, or psychological. Pseudo-anarchism is hardly a politics, and paranoia, however structured, cannot become in itself an ideology. What will sustain the reader of The Crying of Lot 49 and keep her eagerly going is the local life of the novel, the human surprises that belong neither to the Tristero nor to American paranoia, assuming as I do that we can keep that duo apart. When I think about The Crying of Lot 49, I always first recall Oedipus' vivid descent into the night world of San Francisco, with its repeated appearances of the image of a muted post-horn, symbol of the Tristero, which appears to be indeed the underground organization of those whom Dostoevsky had called the insulted and injured. Oedipa goes into the San Francisco night so as to cure her Tristero obsession. She had only to drift tonight at random and watch nothing happen to be convinced it was purely nervous, a little something for her shrink to fix. Swept by tumultuous tourists into a gay bar, she instantly spots a pin on a sport coat in the shape of the Tristero emblem. It turns up again in a Chinatown herbalist's window, and chalked on a sidewalk, in rhymes chanted at a jump rope game, until she re-encounters Jesus Arabal, a Mexican anarchist who defines a miracle as another world's intrusion into this one. This has its affinities to the Tristero's code name, Waste, W-A-S-T-E. We await silent Tristero's empire. Again and again, too numerous to count, the enigmatic signs of the pseudo-anarchist conspiracy confront Oedipa and the reader. By morning, Oedipa is convinced that the dispossessed have withdrawn wholly from the United States government and its postal system. What follows that self-persuasion is a moment of astonishing poignance, though I suppose nothing in Pynchon should ever astonish his reader. Oedipa encounters a huddled old man shaking with grief, but with the posthorn tattooed on the back of his left hand. Hardly knowing what she does, she comforts him, holding him to her breast while she rocks him, as though he were her baby. She is childless. After mailing a letter for the old man, via Tristero, she attempts to trace the underground postal system, but fails. That, and all her subsequent adventures, and all previous, may count for less than her cradling of the destitute old man in her arms. Like West's Shrike and Miss Lonely Hearts, Oedipa has been more a deliberate cartoon than a Faulknerian or Shakespearean character until now. I think she gets away from Pynchon here, as no one else in his work does until the great change in his art in Mason and Dixon, where both personages in the title are fully humanized figures. How are we to read Oedipa's sudden emergence into so superb a compassion? Other moments of reality break through the fantasy structures of The Crying of Lot 49, but this is the grandest. In the pages of nearly any other writer, it might seem sentimental, but not when it manifests in Pynchon. In the book's closing scene, Oedipa attends the auction of Inverarity's invaluable stamp collection, including the Tristero forgeries, which are to be sold as Lot 49. The final moment comes as the auctioneer clears his throat and Oedipa settles back to await the crying of Lot 49. We have come full circle to the title again, and have more clues to what might happen than any reader will be inclined to interpret. It may be 49 days since Easter Sunday, and then again it may not. I think not. We are not about to hear Oedipa break out into a Pentecostal speaking with tongues, nor is it likely that either an angel or a dove will descend. Nor do I think that Oedipa herself will bid for Lot 49. Presumably, a representative of the Tristero will bid for it successfully, but if Oedipa follows him out, he will speed away, and she will be left in limbo, which is where Pynchon has placed her, and with her the readers. There are worse places to be. Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian. Blood Meridian, 1985, seems to me the authentic American apocalyptic novel, more relevant even in 2000 than it was 15 years ago. The fulfilled renown of Moby Dick and of As I Lay Dying is augmented by Blood Meridian, since Cormac McCarthy is the worthy disciple both of Melville and of Faulkner. I venture that no other living American novelist, not even Pynchon, has given us a book as strong and memorable as Blood Meridian. Much as I appreciate Don DeLillo's Underworld, Philip Roth's Zuckerman Bound, Sabbath's Theatre and American Pastoral, and Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow and Mason and Dixon. McCarthy himself, in his recent border trilogy, commencing with the superb All the Pretty Horses, has not matched Blood Meridian. But it is the ultimate Western, not to be surpassed. My concern being the reader, I will begin by confessing that my first two attempts to read through Blood Meridian failed, because I flinched from the overwhelming carnage that McCarthy portrays. The violence begins on the novel's second page, when the 15-year-old kid is shot in the back and just below the heart, and continues almost with no respite until the end, 30 years later, when Judge Holden, the most frightening figure in all of American literature, murders the kid in an outhouse. So appalling are the continuous massacres and mutilations of Blood Meridian that one could be reading a United Nations report on the horrors of Kosovo in 1999. Nevertheless, I urge the reader to persevere because Blood Meridian is a canonical imaginative achievement, both an American and a universal tragedy of blood. Judge Holden is a villain worthy of Shakespeare, Iago-like and demoniac, a theoretician of war everlasting. And the book's magnificence, its language, landscape, persons, conceptions, at last transcends the violence and convert goriness into terrifying art, an art comparable to Melville's and to Faulkner's. When I teach the book, many of my students resist it initially, as I did, and as some of my friends continue to do. Television saturates us with actual as well as imagined violence, and I turn away, either in shock or in disgust. But I cannot turn away from Blood Meridian, now that I know how to read it, and why it has to be read. None of its carnage is gratuitous or redundant. It belonged to the Mexico-Texas borderlands in 1849 to 1850. Which is where and when most of the novel is set. I suppose one could call Blood Meridian a historical novel, since it chronicles the actual expedition of the Glanton Gang, a murderous paramilitary force sent out both by Mexican and Texan authorities to murder and scalp as many Indians as possible. Yet it does not have the aura of historical fiction, since what it depicts seethes on in the United States, and nearly everywhere else, as we enter the third millennium. Judge Holden, the prophet of war, is unlikely to be without honor in our years to come. Even as you learn to endure the slaughter McCarthy describes, you become accustomed to the book's high style, again as overtly Shakespearean as it is Faulknerian. There are passages of Melvillian, Faulknerian, Baroque richness and intensity in The Crying of Lot 49, and elsewhere in Pynchon, but we can never be sure that they are not parodistic. The prose of Blood Meridian soars, yet with its own economy, and its dialogue is always persuasive, particularly when the uncanny Judge Holden speaks. Chapter 14, page 199. The judge placed his hands on the ground. He looked at his inquisitor. "This is my claim," he said, "and yet everywhere upon it are pockets of autonomous life. Autonomous. In order for it to be mine, nothing must be permitted to occur upon it save by my dispensation." Toadvine sat with his boots crossed before the fire. "No man can acquaint himself with everything on this earth," he said. The judge tilted his great head. "The man who believes that the secrets of this world are forever hidden lives in mystery and fear. Superstition will drag him down. The rain will erode the deeds of his life. But that man who sets himself the task of singling out the thread of order from the tapestry will, by the decision alone, have taken charge of the world. and it is only by such taking charge that he will effect a way to dictate the terms of his own fate. Judge Holden is the spiritual leader of Glanton's filibusters, and McCarthy persuasively gives the self-styled judge a mythic status, appropriate for a deep Machiavelli, whose thread of order recalls Iago's magic web, in which Othello, Desdemona, and Cassio are caught. Though all of the more colorful and murderous raiders are vividly characterized for us, the killing machine Glanton with the others, the novel turns always upon its two central figures, Judge Holden and the Kid. We first meet the judge on page 6, an enormous man, bald as a stone, no trace of a beard, and eyes without either brows or lashes. A 7-foot-tall albino almost seems to have come from some other world. And we learn to wonder about the judge, who never sleeps, dances and fiddles with extraordinary art and energy, rapes and murders little children of both sexes, and who says that he will never die. By the book's close, I have come to believe that the judge is immortal. And yet the judge, while both more and less than human, is as individuated as Iago or Macbeth, and is quite at home in the Texan-Mexican borderlands, where we watch him operate in 1849 to 1850, and then find him again in 1878, not a day older, after 28 years, though the Kid, a 16-year-old at the start of Glanton's foray, is 45 when murdered by the judge at the end. McCarthy subtly shows us the long, slow development of the Kid from another mindless scalper of Indians to the courageous confronter of the judge in their final debate in a saloon. But though the Kid's moral maturation is heartening, his personality remains largely a cipher, as anonymous as his lack of a name. The three glories of the book are the judge, the landscape, and, dreadful to say this, the slaughters, which are aesthetically distanced by McCarthy in a number of complex ways. What is the reader to make of the judge? He is immortal as principle, as war everlasting, but is he a person or something other? McCarthy will not tell us, which is all the better, since the ambiguity is most stimulating. Melville's Captain Ahab, though a Promethean demigod, is necessarily mortal and perishes with the Pequod and all its crew, except for Ishmael. After he has killed the Kid, Blood Meridian's Ishmael, Judge Holden, is the last survivor of Glanton's scalping crusade. Destroying the Native American nations of the Southwest is hardly analogous to the hunt to slay Moby Dick, and yet McCarthy gives us some curious parallels between the two quests. The most striking is between Melville's chapter 19, where a ragged prophet who calls himself Elijah warns Ishmael and Queequeg against sailing on the Pequod, and McCarthy's chapter 4, where an old, disordered Mennonite warns the Kid and his comrades not to join Captain Worth's filibuster, a disaster that preludes the greater catastrophe of Glanton's campaign. McCarthy's invocation of Moby Dick, while impressive and suggestive, in itself does not do much to illuminate Judge Holden for us. Ahab has his preternatural aspects, including his harpooner Fadala and Parsi whaleboat crew, and the captain's conversion to their Zoroastrian faith. Elijah tells Ishmael touches of other Ahabian mysteries, a 3-day trance off Cape Horn, slaying a Spaniard in front of a presumably Catholic altar in Santa, and a wholly enigmatic spitting into a silver calabash. Yet all these are transparencies compared to the enigmas of Judge Holden, who seems to judge the entire earth and whose name suggests a holding, presumably of sway over all he encounters. And yet, the judge, unlike Ahab, is not wholly fictive. Like Glanton, he is a historic filibuster or freebooter. McCarthy tells us most in the kid's dream visions of Judge Holden, towards the close of the novel, chapter 22, pages 309 to 310. In that sleep, and in sleep to follow, the judge did visit. Who would come other? A great shambling mutant, silent and serene. Whatever his antecedents, he was something wholly other than their sum, nor was there system by which to divide him back into his origins, for he would not go. Whoever would seek out his history, through what